So I think Bianca's already let you know most of the practical details that we need for finishing up. Just from my point of view for this session here, I'll see if I can answer most of the questions that people have given, and if I can't answer the questions, I'll just at least try to make a joke about it. And those and those people whose questions I have made a joke about it, I just want to express my apologies to you and to ask for your forgiveness and to praise you for being a great bodhisattva, for helping to bring joy to others. Now, after that, we'll go and do the clean-up of the cottages and so on. When you've done that, you can come back and do some meditation. If we can meet here, if everybody can come and meet here at 10:30, okay? And we'll do a bit of a wrap-up of the retreat and we'll have a group photograph, okay? Is that all right? Okay, good. No, a few shaking heads. Anyway, if you want to escape the group photo, that's all right. And just to make sure I remember it, I've put the forms out for the survey. So if you completed part one of the survey, then if you could continue with part two, that would be terrific. If you didn't complete part one, then you've missed out. You'll never have this chance again, anyway. So, of course, if you've done part one and you don't want to do part two, then, of course, that's fine. There's no need to do anything. But if you do want to continue with part two, which I would really appreciate, then the forms are there. If you can fill them out and put them in the box. And very, very, very important, remember your code number. You are not a person. You are just a number to us, okay? It's very important. It preserves the integrity of the information because the person who's doing analysing the data doesn't know your name, doesn't know anything about you. But if we have the number, then we can track the progress through the retreat. If we don't have the numbers, all we can do is a statistical analysis, which gives us much less information. So it really helps us if you can remember that code number, and the code number was the number that you wrote. Oh, sorry, that was already on the top right-hand corner of the front page of the first survey, and then we asked you to try to remember that. So if you can write that same code number on this form. Now, after this retreat's finished, we're going to be sending part three of the survey in 2 weeks' time. Okay, so basically this is going to be checking up whether you're continuing to practice or not. So, but it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah, to see how far that thing. Obviously it would be, you know, good to track it even further, but for this time we're just doing 2 weeks, okay? So we're going to send that part three to your email address. And specifically, we're going to use the same list of email addresses that we used before the retreat to inform you that this survey was going to happen, okay? So hopefully most of you received that email address, which was, I think, the one that you put in when you first applied for the retreat. If you did not get an email notification before the retreat, if you showed up at this retreat and you didn't know that this survey was going to happen, yeah, and if you are taking part in the survey, then please give us your email address. And I've put a sheet of paper at the front desk there for you to write your email address there. That's so we can send you part three. Because we're just using the general email list, we'll send that to everyone, and some people will get that even if they're not doing the survey. Okay, so our apologies for that, but I think it's better to send a few extra emails rather than risk missing anybody out. So if you've not done the survey, or if you don't want to do part three and you get the email anyway, then our apologies, and please just delete it and no need to worry about it, okay? So we will, when the survey is analysed, and then we will be contacting the organisers and letting you know what the findings were. Okay, so we're not sure yet in what form that will be. Hopefully, this will be written up as an article to be submitted to a peer-reviewed journal. But in any case, we'll make the findings available in some form. Yeah. Yeah, how does that work? No, I think what will happen is that will be probably, I think that will be sent from here, yeah, from the same. So, Dania, because you sent the emails previously, can you also do part three? So the emails will all be sent here to part to this email address with the code number on the individual forms, yeah. Then Dania will collect all those and then send all those documents to us, so they won't come to us, the experimenters, directly from the people. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that'll keep it anonymous, yeah. So it might seem like a bit much for those of you who are not familiar with it. It might seem a bit excessive, you're just writing down whether you feel happy or not and all this kind of secrecy and stuff, but that's part of the process for doing these kinds of surveys, is to keep the information anonymous. Okay. Okay. So some questions. Okay. Would I recommend The Path of Purification? This is a book called Visuddhimagga, translated as The Path of Purification, for someone who wants familiarity with a more systematized version of the Buddhist path and practices. I have heard conflicting recommendations. So yes, I definitely would recommend the Path of Purification. It's very widely available. You find copies at the BSWA, and you'll find quite readily available for free distribution. So it's a nice big thick book, so you can sort of, you know, it looks impressive on your bookshelf and stuff like that. So it's an it's a extremely important book for understanding Theravada Buddhism. It's in fact the definitive volume around which all the rest of Theravada Buddhism really revolves, composed in 400 and something AD by the great Master Buddhaghosa, and it forms the centerpiece of the Theravadan commentarial system. Extremely well translated by the English monk Nyanamoli, with copious footnotes and an excellent introduction that gives the whole history and background. So strongly recommend, especially the introduction. And to reading the Visuddhimagga is a variable kind of experience. Some parts of it are somewhat unreadable, highly technical and stylized, but much of it is actually good fun. There's lots of excellent stories and illustrations and examples. And it makes a lot more sense if you think of the Visuddhimagga not so much as a book to, you know, sit down and read like we read a book, but it's more like a manual for teachers. Yeah, so it's more like a reference book, which you can sort of use as a guide if you're someone who's teaching the path of Buddhism. In many ways, it's very useful. The whole thing, it starts out with a verse of the Dhamma, and it says that with one verse from the Saggatawagga, and it says, you know, this world is entangled in a tangle, a tangle within a tangle without. This world is tangled in a tangle. How do we untangle the tangle? And then it says, basically, you untangle the tangle through practicing sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Yeah, and then it says, well, what does sila, samadhi, panya mean? And then the rest of the Visuddhimagga is explaining that. So it's the whole thing is like a commentary on this one verse about how to untangle the tangle. And a lot of the really essential ideas that we find in the Theravada meditation teachings are primarily derived from the Visuddhimagga. There are conflicting recommendations, and it's a text which has tended to sort of provoke somewhat extreme responses because it is so highly revered within the Theravadan tradition. It's basically as an authoritative and infallible tome within the sort of traditional conservative Theravada. And so the responses to that tend to be, well, no, there are mistakes with it, therefore it's a load of rubbish and you should throw it out. Whereas I tend to sort of want to kind of steer a bit more of a middle way and say not everything necessarily you're going to want to take as being gospel truth, as they say, but much of it is extremely useful. Okay, Pandey, can you recommend an abridged version of the suttas for a novice Buddhist, and where can I buy this? Thank you. An abridged version, a short version. Well, probably the best one is the volume that was brought out by Bhikkhu Bodhi a couple of years ago for that very purpose. I think it's called In the Buddha's Words. I think that's the title. Anyone familiar? A few people nodding. In the Buddha's Words, yeah, by Bhikkhu Bodhi, published through Wisdom Publications, and it's a series, I think 10 chapters, which give essential sutta passages and arranged according to a thematic presentation. So, and very well explained and put together, as is everything by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So that would be the ideal introduction. And I would guess you can buy it at the BSWA. Yeah, is that right? Yeah. And if you've got any questions about that, you can ask the librarian at the BSWA library. And, of course, also available online. Okay, can we meet the nuns and hear a little of each of them about themselves? Okay, here we go. That was easy. Is Ines about to say something? No?
Thank you.
course, as you know, Atumayama's also been doing the retreat with us, but because of her health, she's not here this morning. So I'm not sure if Atumayama will join us for the 10:30. Probably not coming up. Okay. Okay. Dear Bhante, do you know of any records in the suttas of the Buddha joking and laughing? Is anything said of humour in the texts? Well, it's a bit of a, as with so many of these questions, a bit of a controversial issue. And the Theravadin school very famously says that an arahant can't laugh. And I'm like even if you told him a really, really good joke, he still wouldn't laugh. Apparently not. So this is why you see in some Theravadin countries, the kind of the whole monk's image. Because the less kind of emotion you have, then the more enlightened you are. There's certainly, you have this kind of famous, the Buddha had a famous smile. And actually, even though I said according to the Theravada that the arahants don't smile, don't laugh, but what is very nice is in the Theravada and Abhidhamma they have a specific class of consciousness, which is the class one of the 129 forms of consciousness according to the Theravada Abhidhamma, and the specific function of that class of consciousness is to cause smiling in arahants. So it only does one thing, yeah. So I think that's quite sweet. You have this kind of quite famous smile that the Buddha would do. He always had this kind of Mona Lisa kind of smile. And sometimes he would smile at various occasions and Ananda would think to himself, Buddhas don't smile for no reason. Let me ask about the reason why. And so the Buddha would always have some Dhamma reason why he'd been smiling. As far as humour goes in the suttas, there's actually a lot of humour in the suttas which is employed in a very kind of gentle way. Although it's quite gentle, there's a few kind of slapstick moments in the suttas, I have to admit. Like the ascetic in the I can't remember the name of the sutta now, who wanted to go and challenge the Buddha to a debate, but he found that his bottom got stuck to his seat and as wriggle as much as he could, he just couldn't get up from his seat to go and challenge the Buddha. So there's a few kind of slapstick moments like that, and then there's the one where there's the time in the Udana when the Sariputta has just shaved his head, and his head's very clean shaven and bright and shining. He's sitting meditation in the full moon night, and his head is so clean and shining. And these two yuccas walk past, and one of them says to the other, "Look at that monk meditating." And he says, "That's just so tempting. I've got my great big club here. I just can't resist this. I just want to give him a whack on that shiny head." And the other yaka says, "No, don't do it, friend. That's a very powerful monk. If you hit him, who knows what could happen?" He says, "But it's just so tempting. I just can't help myself." So then he gives him a blow on the head big enough to split a mountain in two. Afterwards, Sariputta just sits there completely unperturbed. Afterwards, his friend Mahamoggallana says to him, "Friend Sariputta, did you notice anything unusual in that meditation?" He said, "No, I didn't feel anything." He said, "Although I do have a slight headache." And then there's the one in the Kewada Sutta. A lot of the humour you see in the Pali Canon is about pricking religious pomposity. Yeah, so the Buddha tended to have a bit of kind of humour around the Brahmins and people like that who are so kind of puffed up with their pride and so on. So this is kind of humour is one of the best ways to sort of bring this down. One of the classic examples in the Kewada Sutta And Buddha tells the story of this monk who wanted to know the answer to the question, where do the four great elements cease without remainder? And so he travelled to the realms of the gods, to each realms of the gods, using his psychic powers and asking all of the gods, where do the four great elements cease without remainder? And none of them knew, and they kept on sending him higher and higher to the higher heaven realms, until finally he went to the Brahma realm, and they said, go to see Brahma, he'll know where the four great elements end without remainder, because Brahma knows everything. And then finally Brahma appears, and the monk asks him, where do the four great elements cease without remainder? And Brahma says to him, I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the maker, the creator, the father of all, the creator of all that have been and will come to be. There is nothing I do not know. And the monk says to him, yeah, I didn't ask you whether you were the father, the maker, the creator, the lord of all that has been and come to be. I asked you, where do the four great elements cease without remainder? And he says to him, I am Brahma, the great Brahma. And then eventually, after asking this a few times, the Brahma takes the monk by the arm, leads him to one side and says, listen, monk, actually, everyone here thinks I know everything, but actually I haven't got a clue what the answer to this question is. But I'd be kind of pleased if you just didn't let them know that, all right? And you should go and ask the Buddha. He's the one who can give you the answer to the question. So you find these kinds of things quite commonly in the suttas, and it's actually become a topic of discussion among Buddhist academics in the last couple of decades. And one reason being is that as with the general tendency in Bible studies is, if you look at a lot of the kind of the more personal kind of things, the kind of the some of the parables and so on, they seem to be quite they seem to betray the presence of a particular kind of personality, and so this is one of the arguments which the text critical scholars say is that these kinds of dialogues and so on are characteristic of the Buddha himself, because they're quite particular, they're quite personal, they're not something which would have been put together by a committee of redactors. So it actually has been quite a serious study of object of study. Okay, dear Bhante Sujato, we heart you. Please come back again soon. Your teachings have been entertaining, enlightening, and heartfelt with metta. Also, thank you. Okay, this body is anicca. It will come to an end. How to die right? How to die right? That's a very good question, isn't it? And it's one which was addressed in many different suttas. And he said, for example, that the practice of metta, if you practice metta and master it, then one of the advantages of that is that you die unconfused. Yeah. Also, one of the advantages of practicing breath meditation, if you practice breath meditation and really master that, then even your last breath you'll be aware of. Yeah. So this is quite possible. And somebody who... There are many stories about this of people who have very dignified and very aware deaths. One story I heard many, many years ago was of this upasika in Bangkok. She's one of these long-term lay women, been practicing for many years, and she was lying on her deathbed. And she was, you know, she didn't have long to go. And her daughter was sitting beside her and trying to encourage her in her Dhamma practice and saying, keep the Buddha in mind, keep Buddha in mind, don't forget the Buddha, don't forget the Dhamma. And the mother said to the daughter, her last words to her daughter were, could you please be quiet, I'm trying to meditate. It's So if you're really establishing the practice, yeah, these things become automatic, yeah? So we like to think that we can be of help to somebody who's dying, yeah? And somebody who hasn't practiced, and yes, we can be and we should be of help, but somebody who's really practiced, their mind will automatically go to the Dhamma at that time, and we can just let them get on with it. Sorry, I missed the name there. What was the name?
Webu
Sado. Webu Sado, yeah. 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 Sure if that's correct. Generally speaking, okay, so that question, it's a question which does come up, and so just to repeat it for those who might not have heard, but then it's been said that if at the time of death, if you do Brahma Viharas, you get reborn in the heavenly realm, and if you're mindful, you get reborn in the human realm. Just one canonical example, there's a sutta in the Digha Nikaya where it specifically says, gives a story and says that somebody by regaining mindfulness was reborn in a higher heaven realm. So it's sometimes said that if you practice jhanas that you get reborn in the Brahma realm and it's better to be reborn in the heaven realm. But actually if you look in the suttas, what it says is that if you practice jhanas outside of the Buddha's dispensation and you haven't practiced vipassana and you don't have right view, then you get reborn in the Brahma realm. But somebody who practices jhanas, who has right view, will go towards nibbana. What the suttas do say will affect your rebirth is that you can make a determination. Yeah? So you can make a resolution to be reborn in one realm or another. So for somebody who has got their mindfulness up to the time of death, if they want to, then you can make a resolution to say if you'd like to be reborn in the human realm because you think that there's a better chance to practice here, and specifically you want to be reborn in Perth so you can keep coming to the BSWA and do retreats in Jhana Grove, which is not unreasonable because most places in the world, if you're going to be reborn, you're not going to have such a good chance to practice. So it's actually a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Then you can do that, yeah? So you can make that resolution at the time of your death. And if of course, if the karma is appropriate, it doesn't replace the karma that you've done, but if the karma is appropriate, then that can be effective. Okay, so here's a few questions. It's a very densely written page here. How long are you staying in Perth for? Till Tuesday, I think. I haven't checked my flight details yet. Seeing as you were born in Perth, being a local boy and all, wouldn't it make more sense to be a monk in Perth? Huh? What does Sydney have that Perth doesn't have anyway? Has an opera house. Has some very lovely bridges. Beautiful harbour. Cliffs. And It has a monastery with people who are rather expecting me to return to it. So, sounds a tad kind of selfish there, but you know, when I was in Bodhnyana for 3 years earlier. I came, I think, in 1997, and stayed. I left 1999. And then spent a year in Malaysia, and then a bit more than a year in Thailand, then came back. Actually, I was more or less planning to end up back in Bodhnyana when I came back to Australia, but I kind of stopped off at Sati Monastery just to sort of check it out and see what was happening there, And, 8 years later, I'm still there. So so I won't do all the rest of it, but thank you, Bhante, for your teachings, and you've taught so much about Dhamma and Metta. I want to learn more. Thank you for teaching and sharing. I wish we could stay longer on the jhana retreat, but we've learned that this too shall end. This is impermanence and I don't like it. So can we have a petition to keep me here? Well, you can try if you like. Very kind. Okay. Kopkun Padi Haija. Kopkun Tohi Haija. Okay, so here's a message in Thai. Thank you, thank you. For the teachings. Okay, so is it possible to experience both a jhana and a complete dissolution at different times if one is practicing both samatha and vipassana meditation? Yes, that's quite possible and quite normal. The stronger the samadhi is, the deeper the sense of letting go that comes through vipassana also. And then could we have a guided vipassana meditation before the end of the retreat, or we did that last night? So, and again, just to say with the vipassana, I mean, we could have obviously spent much more time on that. We only just really give it a taste for it, and the reason why is basically two reasons. One is because there's a lot of people teaching vipassana already, so I feel less need to do that. But also because I think that for most people, what we actually really need is a bit of peace and a bit of love and a bit of wholeness, and that's actually the most important thing for most people, where we're actually at. Okay, this is a very serious question. I know monks aren't supposed to talk about their attainments, but I have to ask, is Bhikkhu Teddy enlightened? He may well be, but he's never going to tell you. Right? Okay. So this is one. Oh, this is one with some nice little shiny stars on it. So whoever did this one, thanks for going that extra mile for some nice shiny stars and hearts and things. Very good. Okay, so thanks for the refreshing teaching. You have an interesting way of putting things together with the analogy of the wine for the Brahma Viharas. And what stood out for me was your encouragement to inquire and imply wisdom to Dhamma in everyday life. Thanks for your discernment you've made and shared with us through your own inquiry. So thank you. Oh, okay. How does one know an inference has been made? Okay, so this is coming back to what I talked about the night before last, about the different aspects of developing wisdom. How do you know an inference has been made? Essentially, it's a kind of mysterious kind of thing, but. An inference happens when you reach a conclusion to a problem, or when you feel that there's an answer to a problem. I mean, a classic example of this is Sherlock Holmes, right? And if any of you have read kind of Sherlock Holmes, I'm sure you're all kind of familiar with these things. And these kind of classic examples that somebody would come into the room and sit down with him, and Sherlock Holmes would immediately say, well, apart from the fact that you're a professor of history who has a knee problem and has just broken up with their wife and has a love of Shakespeare, I know nothing about you. And they say, how do you know that? Well, and he says, I knew all these things because he can pick up the signs, yeah? Or he'll walk into a room where there was a crime and he'll notice there's a book out of place there and the curtain's been undone there. And this chair was moved, therefore the butler did it, right? And he comes to that inference, yeah? And of course, inference is not proof. But then the proof of that comes, well, then you test it. You then have to find out, yeah? You then follow that through and see whether that initial inference is correct. And of course, sometimes it's not, sometimes it is, and then you follow that through and see. But that's one of the things, the development of wisdom, is you know when you have a certain caution and humility about your inferences. You know, well, this is just a conclusion that I've reached and it may or may not be correct. And you learn through time and through experience when it is that your intuitions can be trusted and when they can't. Yeah? And you learn to kind of reflect on that. When am I just jumping to conclusions? And when is this something which is a genuine inference? Okay, so this is about the post-retreat survey form. And yes, the form to complete is on the same table as you completed the form last time. We've put the form for part two out there already. So please, if you can do that, if you'd like to. The Abhante, will your talks be made available online? So I believe so, yes. Dani is responsible for that. Is that right? So you can annoy Dania. Sorry? Okay, very good. Okay, is there any difference between upakilesa and anusaya kilesa? Thank you for your response. Okay, so this is referring to a couple of terms which are used in the Pali texts. Now, the Buddhist scriptures have a very rich and very complex vocabulary in talking about psychology and the different aspects of the mind. For example, you know, we've been using the word metta to talk about loving kindness, and Pali actually has, you know, metta and pema and raga and chanda and many, many other words which all refer to love in one way or another, all of which have their own different connotations. Now, this question here is about what we call the kilesas, and kilesa is usually translated as defilement. The basic meaning of the word kilesa is something like a dye or something which is put into a cloth which colours it. And here, two different uses. One is the word upa kilesa and the other one anusaya. Now, upa kilesa is typically used in the suttas to... It is used in a limited way, usually. It's not a completely defined technical term, but usually it's used in the suttas to specifically mean the subtle forms of defilements and agitation and obstructions which are hindering the mind from gaining samadhi, from gaining jhanas. Sometimes just a synonym for the five hindrances, but also just for more those kind of subtle feelings of restlessness or subtle feeling of agitation or something, which is still in the mind, which, you know, the mind might be reasonably peaceful and so on in meditation, but those kind of subtle forces are usually what upakilesa means. So perhaps you'd translate it as residual defilements, perhaps. Anusaya has quite a different meaning. Anusaya means the underlying, literally anusaya means underlying or inherent tendencies. And what anusaya refers to is the fact that in our consciousness, even when we might not have a particular quality or whatever which is manifested, but it's still underlying, it's still there in potential. So these are like the potential kind of defilements. So the example is given of a little baby who can't have greed or anger or something like that. So it says baby can't have any anger apart from just whining, and can't have any restlessness apart from just wriggling. but still the anusayas are there. So it has this underlying potential. So another way of looking at that is that the upakilesas are overcome through the practice of samadhi, and the anusayas are overcome through the practice of vipassana, through the practice of wisdom. Okay, so dear Bhante, by the time you get to see this note, both my mind and body would have left the retreat. Well, all I can say is I'm glad that they left together, and hopefully on good terms. I just want to say a big thank you for the teachings you've given us in the retreat. May you be well, peaceful and happy. My sixth sense tells me that we'll meet each other again. See you sometime in the future. Okay, may it be so. Okay, so dear Bhante, oh, here's another one. Please come back and teach another retreat in Perth at least once a year. You'll really appreciate it. Thank you. I'm beginning to sense a theme here. Okay, Bhante, do you have any further thoughts as to the role diet and exercise play in maintaining a body mind that functions effectively for the practice of meditation? Okay, what about fasting? And also, why do we have so many high sugar foods, especially the foods available in the afternoon, when they cause so many health problems? Do Thai forest monks ever play sport? The Buddha died from food poisoning, and monastics are supposed to eat what's given to them. Would a different approach to the role of food and physical activity help those on the path to live a longer, healthier life, to move beyond this samsara in a body that was well adapted? Okay, yeah, it is a kind of a controversial, or not controversial, but it's an interesting thing. And if you look at the way that meditation and spirituality has developed in the West in the last 30 years and so, there's a strong emphasis on this kind of integration, isn't it? Like if you pick up a spirituality magazine, it'll have one article on vegetarianism, another article on yoga, and another article on meditation. And these things all kind of go together, and we think of them very closely related. And they are, in a sense, that's more similar. You'll find that a lot in Chinese cultural spheres, in places like Malaysia and Singapore. You find a similar kind of integration of these different aspects coming from the Taoist tradition. Whereas in the Theravada tradition, not so much. Theravada tradition, as it says, the attitude towards food is, especially for the monastics, is just, well, just to eat whatever is offered. Of course, that being the outcome of a mendicant tradition. I personally believe that there's a lot to be said for that. I think that these days we become, yes, of course, to be aware of and, you know, conscious of what you're eating is important, but you know, I think it becomes often quite obsessive, and we think that we have to know all of the details and so on in everything, and we forget that, but you know, before a generation or two ago, no one had ever heard of vitamins, and yet they somehow managed to live. Yeah, no one had ever heard of whatever these antioxidants and things like that, and a lot of these things get made into almost fetishes without very little actual evidence that they actually have any health benefits at all. I mean, antioxidants is a huge fad, and there's almost no evidence that they do anything at all, except for enable makers of coffee and chocolate to market themselves as health foods. I think the reality is that, you know, the best kind of diet is to eat a moderate amount of fresh and natural whole foods. You know, probably that's as good as you're going to get most of the time. If you look in the monastic community, you see there's a lot of old monks who are pretty healthy and stuff. You know, you look at Ajahn Mahabhur, and he's still, you know, was active and well until his 90s. And that's not that unusual. So I don't think there's any particular reason to think that the monastic diet is any less healthy. And, you know, one of the things that we don't notice, but I've seen, and there are some studies that have shown that if you do blessings at the mealtime, that it's actually healthier. Yeah. And I think that's very, that's something that we tend to overlook. And we think that the food is purely just this bunch of chemicals. And if we get the chemicals right, then we're going to be healthier. Whereas, in fact, I think the evidence shows that if you eat food with a mindful and respectful and reverential attitude, then that itself is very healthy. As far as exercise, that is more or less of an issue depending on the different traditions that you're in. Certainly in the Thai forest tradition, the monks don't do kind of formal exercises as such, but the lifestyle itself, at least traditionally, you know, you do a lot of walking from one monastery to another and a lot of walking meditation, and the monks also do quite a lot of work in the monastery. So there's a lot of sweeping and building and various kinds of activities. So you see, in the Thai forest tradition anyway, the monks generally tend to be pretty fit. In some traditions, people tend to be very sedentary, and I think that is a bit of an issue. I've certainly noticed it myself. I've got a lot less fit the last few years because I haven't been done a lot less physical work and so on in the monastery. I think that's something to be careful of. What about fasting? Fasting is not specifically recommended as a Buddhist practice. Some people do it, and some people say that they get good results from it. Others, not so much. So that's more or less a personal thing. Typically, most people who fast say that, and also my experience is that your mind can become quite peaceful and quite light if you're fasting, but it tends not to go very deep. The mind tends to kind of float a bit. Everything becomes a bit floaty, and it's not, doesn't seem to be so grounded. But it is a very personal thing, so if you're interested to fast, then give it a go. Fasting does have one benefit, and that is that if you know how to fast, then you never get worried if you miss a meal. That's good. High sugar foods. Yeah, I think there's too many high sugar foods. But you know, no one's forcing you to eat them. So. Okay, so that's the last question. So can you explain what is vipassana meditation? Is it that which is taught in Goenka-led vipassana retreats? It seems that the terms vary in meaning. Okay, so that's a good question. To understand it, we have to know a little bit about the history. The word vipassana itself means, as I explained earlier, it means discernment, clear seeing. Okay, it's a literal meaning of the word. And so the Buddha used it in the sense of that aspect of meditation which we use to clearly discern, which leads to the development of wisdom and to the overcoming of ignorance. This is vipassana. That's how the Buddha treated vipassana. And we do that through investigating impermanent suffering and not self. In modern times, vipassana gets used in a related but slightly different sense to mean it's come to mean not the quality of mind, which is what the Buddha was referring to, but instead it means the meditation system. Okay, so it becomes a meditation method. The idea of a meditation method in that sense is a 20th century invention. So if you do a Goenka retreat, they will call that vipassana. If you do a Mahasi retreat, they will call that vipassana, and so on. What that really means is that these are meditation methods whose purpose is to focus on developing that quality of discernment and insight. Okay, so there's really the two things. You know, the meditation method. Of course, you can do the meditation method and you might not have any insight at all, right? That's quite possible, yeah? Just like you might do samatha meditation, which is all about tranquility, and you might be completely untranquil, right? So there's the actual quality of tranquility, but then there's the purpose of that meditation. So the purpose of that method is to lead to vipassana, or the Sanskrit pronunciation the Goenka people often use is vipassana. Within what you often find is that within those circles, so if you're within, say, the Goenka circles or within the Mahasi circles and so on, the people who are familiar with that tradition use as a shorthand the word vipassana or vipassana to refer to their own particular meditation method. Okay, and that's just a question of familiarity. Yeah, so that's just something. As long as we understand that, if you know, within that culture or that environment, when they use the word vipassana, they use it to mean their own method or their own system. But in the more general historical sense, the word vipassana means the discernment. Okay. So do I recommend doing breath meditations, such as taught by Ajahn Brahm, vipassana and metta meditations at various sittings as seems appropriate? Yes, I do. So try doing the different ones at different sittings, and as you get experience, then you will learn and you'll know how each of one affects the mind, what the strengths and weaknesses of each approach are, and how each one will work in that particular context. That's something that will emerge over time. There's no kind of formula for it, but it's good to try the different approaches so that you your mind gains flexibility. And it's also an aspect of wisdom that you learn how the mind responds to the different methods. Okay, so that's it. So it's 9:15 now. So I think it's probably time for us to break and go and do the cleaning of the cottages. And if we come back here for meditation at 10:30, yeah? And oh, I'm not sure, I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but I think it says on the retreat schedule, which I didn't read until this morning, that the retreat finishes at 3 o'clock. But I know that some people will be leaving at the lunchtime, and I know many of you probably have, you know, things that need looking at home. Probably got, you know, cats that haven't been fed for a week and things like that. And after the lunchtime, and if everybody can stay and help with the cleanup after the lunch, as Bianca's already explained to you, so after that there won't be any more formal parts of the retreat, so you're free to leave after the cleanup. If you want to come back and do some more meditation this afternoon, of course, you're welcome, but there won't be any more formal teachings or anything at that time. So, but I'll see you here at 10:30 for the closing and for the photo op. So remember that you're still keeping the 8 precepts, so no makeup for the photo.